8 of the Cricket Hurt Weekly. Now, we are a bit recovered from the World Cup, I think. We've had several full nights sleep this week, which has seemed like an absolute luxury, let me tell you. Now, we did do our kind of Insta reaction straight after the World Cup final last weekend, but we promised you a full post-mortem, so here we are.
Here we go.
First up, obviously, congratulations again to Australia. Much as I say that through slightly gritted teeth because I'm English and it's inevitable that that's going to be through gritted teeth. But we thought we'd just start with our overall reflections on the tournament. So shall I go first? I was just thinking that one of the things that strikes me now looking back is actually how little COVID ended up impacting the tournament from a playing perspective. You know, the ICC were putting in all those crazy rules a month ago and we were complaining going, this is just going to make a mockery of the whole thing if you can play with 9 players and this is insane. But what other options do they have because COVID's just going to ravage the whole thing? And actually, I think only 2 players ended up catching COVID that we know of. Ash Gardner right at the start, and then I think it was Afi Fletcher from West Indies who caught it at the back end. But that's actually quite incredible given how many players there were in that tournament. So that's one thing. On the other hand, I wonder whether COVID impacted on things in a slightly less tangible way, because I know that I was interviewing Nat Siver for a column in The Guardian last weekend ahead of the final, and she was saying that actually one of the slightly disappointing things this tournament compared with 2017 had been the lack of opportunity to communicate with the public and actually go and sign autographs and you know, for people to actually kind of directly meet their heroes, and that meant that you know, it was maybe a little bit of a concern from a legacy perspective if you think about the impact of these tournaments on women's cricket and on the people who go to see them. And I suppose perhaps if we're kind of thinking about the crowd at the final compared with like 2020 when we had 86,000 people at the MCG, or 2017 when we had 24,000 people at Lords, that's actually, I think the official crowd figure in the end that I heard was 5,000, and obviously it was a much smaller ground so it looked like it was full and buzzing, but that's maybe a little bit disappointing perhaps.
Yeah, there was, it kind of contrasts with the ambition, particularly of Cricket Australia. So Cricket Australia, you know, wanted to try and fill the MCG. That obviously felt like a long shot. It would have been one of the biggest crowds. It still is, I believe, one of the 3 biggest crowds ever for a women's sports event. We've actually seen in the last month, I understand, at the Nou Camp in Barcelona, the biggest ever crowd for a women's sports, team sports event. The Barcelona versus Real Madrid women's football match, but the MCG remains, you know, in the top 3 there.
Yeah.
And you know, that was a very ambitious thing to target.
Yeah.
And it kind of feels like New Zealand almost did the opposite. That you know, there are big stadiums in New Zealand. You know, where the New Zealand men play rugby, they also play cricket there via a drop-in pitch. They could have played at one of those big rugby stadiums. They chose not to. They chose to go for, you know, the smaller ground, which they would definitely fill. I guess that, you know, if you've got a little bit less confidence that your home team are going to make the final, then maybe that's a good call. And obviously, it would have looked terrible if they played at one of the big rugby stadiums and it had been, you know, only 10% full. So, you know, I don't blame them in that way. But, you know, I guess that it's a little bit of a difference from Lords, isn't it? And from the MCG in particular.
Yeah, so those are my kind of overall thoughts, I suppose. What about you, Sid?
Well, I think about the cricket. I think that, you know, we've obviously saw quite a close tournament within a tournament in order to kind of qualify for the semi-finals. Nobody really challenging Australia, though. I think that's the key point. So, you know, Australia just clearly way ahead of everyone else.
Yeah.
If anything, even further ahead, you know, than they were 2 years ago. It does mean that you wind up looking more for excitement at the tournament within the tournament. The tournament within the tournament, it was a little bit, I feel, kind of things were settled by a lot of elements of bad play rather than good play. I mean, there was lots to be positive about, but, you know, there were also quite a lot of incidents. You know, England lost 3 matches, 2 of which they kind of played quite badly.
Yeah.
And,
all,
you know,
those dropped catches.
India, you know, went out. You know, as a, not maybe it's a little bit unfair to go, India went out directly as a result of Dipti's no ball. But I mean, you know, how does an off spinner wind up bowling a no ball in that situation as an experienced player? So there's a little bit of an element of, you know, I think that the standard of cricket apart from Australia, probably wasn't quite what we would have wanted to see. And if Australia, you know, had been at the same level as everyone else, it would have been competitive, perhaps a bit more. But I think we've still got some distance to go in terms of, you know, improving the game overall below those very top levels. England and Australia really stamped their dominance on everything in the end, didn't they? I mean, England really showed that they are the second best side in the world via their semi-final result. It was really interesting listening to Mark Robinson talk about England's situation on the Naughty Child podcast. You should go and take a listen to that, yeah, because it's a really fantastic interview with Mark Robinson where he basically just talks for an hour, which is what he does. He talks about, you know, England's upcoming semi-final, as it was then, it was recorded before the semi-final. He said, you know, 9 times out of 10, England are going to beat South Africa. And that's kind of what we've seen, really. You know, South Africa, when Marizan Kaap has a really good game, South Africa can be up there and challenge. But mostly, England are going to power through South Africa, as they did in that semi-final. And yet, despite that, you know, England essentially got flattened in the final. I mean, we can take the positives of Nat Silver's, you know, century and, yeah, you know, the fact that England didn't get bowled out for 50, that it felt less humiliating perhaps than the Indian performance in the 2020 World Cup final, but England still got flattened at the end of the day. Australia are still far too good, and that's probably not great overall for the game going forwards. But right now, I think that we'll just have to celebrate how good Australia are and, you know, try and make the positive moves in the rest of the world, you know, and hope that everyone else can do that to try and, you know, catch up some.
Okay. It's a challenge, isn't it? And it's one that we're increasingly going to face. This is obviously Australia's first 50-over title since 2013. So they haven't quite stamped their dominance on the game in the 50-over format, perhaps. But now you go, well, they're world champions in both formats and they hold the Ashes. And what else is there left? Well, there's a Commonwealth Games gold medal after that. I suppose, you know, they'll be targeting the T20 World Cup next year, but it does start to, you start to go, when are people going to actually switch off and go, this isn't interesting anymore? And that is a bit of a concern. So, I mean, from our perspective, what can England do about all this? It's a question that we've got to face, isn't it? And should I start off with my thoughts on that? Well, I mean, obviously, like the big thing is more investment, isn't it? We need more money going into the system, and we need it yesterday, frankly. That's impossible, but, you know, Claire Connolly needs to be getting out there tomorrow and saying we're going to have more professional contracts at domestic level rather than the 6 or 7 that we've got for each team at the moment, which leaves half of the squad still scrambling together, madly trying to get their act together, and not being able to train properly. So yeah, there's that. I feel concerned. I've talked about this before. I feel concerned that the climate within the rest of the ECB is not favourable for more investment in women's cricket, because there are still people sat there going, oh, we've already put loads of money into it, why do they need more? So I feel a bit anxious about that, but that's what needs to happen, isn't it? And then just in terms of thinking about kind of personnel, it's an interesting one because, well, England now have got 4 weeks off. So they've come back, which is absolutely fair enough. They've had an exhausting winter, haven't they? They were away for months on end. So they've come back. They've now all got 4 weeks off. So they're going to be coming back together in mid-May. And then
hopefully
they're going to have
some nice suntans.
Hopefully, yeah. They're going to have, at that point, they've got roughly 2 months until the start of the Commonwealth Games. And in those 2 months, they've also got an international series against South Africa, which includes a test. Yeah. We said that simultaneously, Sid. Do you think we spend too much time together? So it's quite difficult to see that they've actually got the time to make particularly significant changes at the top. So thinking about the coach and the captain, even if they decide that that's what they wanted to do. If you're trying to appoint a new coach of the England women's team, there's a process you have to go through legally. You have to advertise, has to be an open and transparent recruitment process. They apply the Rooney rule now. You have to have a proper process where you have candidates for interview, and you sit them down, you get them to talk about their vision for the team, and then it takes time.
We'd be the first to criticise the ECB if they didn't follow those processes, regardless of their kind of legal, quasi-legal obligations from Sport England. So it's important.
Yeah, so they haven't got time to do that. So that's the first thing. So we're not going to see a change of coach. To be honest, there's not really any time for England to change coach from now right up until the end of the English season at the end of September. So, you know, that's the situation with that. And then in terms of Heather Knight, I know that there's, you know, that, of course, when you lose a World Cup final badly, there are always going to be people sort of talking about that and the future of who's going to carry on captaining the team. Well, you know, it's going to be quite difficult at this point to bring in a new captain because there isn't that much time. And also, you know, I was thinking about this yesterday. Who have England actually got in their starting 11 at the moment with any captaincy experience? There just aren't that many. So if you go through the list, who's actually captained their domestic team? I think that the only two candidates I could come up with were Anya Shrubsole, who obviously has captained Somerset, and I think she captained the Brave in the 100. Yep. But we know that England don't consider her a plausible candidate for the captaincy because they took the vice captaincy away from her a couple of years ago. And then the other person you've got in their ODI starting 11 is Kate Cross, who I believe captained the originals last season and has also been
captain of Lancashire
and the Thunder more recently. So she's got captaincy experience. On the other hand, she's not in their T20 11. So you'd have to then go, well, we need a different captain for that format. She's also a bowler. They don't like making bowlers captain. So you just kind of go, well, there isn't anybody kind of waiting in the wings to take over. And it's really poor succession planning. So that's something that they really need to tackle, like pretty much head on straight away, is who is going to take over from Heather, and we are going to properly mentor them over the next year so that there is somebody in place who knows what they're doing. We can no longer just stumble along going, oh, well, we'll push that back to, you know, to after the next major tournament, because there's too many major tournaments now. Well, you know, you've got the Commonwealth Games and then the T20 World Cup next year, and then after that you'll have another World Cup to be thinking about and an Ashes and all of that stuff. And it's just no longer feasible to just keep pushing everything down the road.
So what you're saying is they need to deal with the next captain what they did with Heather when Heather was made the vice captain to Lottie, you know,
exactly.
eight or nine years ago.
Yeah, and she did that for 2 years.
But realistically, Raph, is there not only one potential candidate for that? Who is I mean, Dunks is the obvious candidate, Sophia Dunkley. Is there another potential candidate, or are we just talking about Sophia Dunkley here? Are we saying Sophia Dunkley should be named England vice captain going into the series against South Africa?
I think that's a pretty good shout, to be honest. Because you have to have somebody who you are fairly confident is going to definitely be in your 11 and is going to warrant a place on merit, as far as I'm concerned.
And who is still going to be in your 11 and warrant a place on merit in 4 years' time.
Yeah, exactly. So I think Dunks is a good candidate. Somebody else that's a possibility would be Charlie Dean, perhaps, in terms of a young player. But as far as I'm aware, neither of them have any captaincy experience. So that's what I mean about if you are looking around, you need to be giving these people mentoring so that they actually do end up with some experience. They're not coming to the job totally cold.
Charlie Dean did captain Hampshire in the T20 stuff
okay.
last year.
Oh, there you go then. So she's
she has done a little
candidate.
Bit. But obviously, she's not playing very many games for Hampshire, and she's certainly not going to play many games for Hampshire this year, right?
And it's tricky in the sense of, you know, Dunks seems to have kind of cemented her place in the T20 and ODI format, and I don't know whether Dean has done that yet in the eyes of Lisa Kightley and Heather Knight. I'm not sure.
Yeah, but we'll see, I guess. But I think that it's a pretty good call that what England need to consider is, like, you know, what's going to start to happen when this team does start to break up, because that's what they've not done in so many ways.
Yeah, and you obviously wrote a piece about this for Cricket Her, which is a little bit controversial, Siv, about the fact that really they need to be acting right now, and they almost need to go, well, we don't mind what happens in the Commonwealth Games.
Yeah, well, you need to start thinking about the next World Cup. So what I'm thinking about is, what's the priority here? You know, if the priority here is to win the Commonwealth Games, if you go, well, that's our be-all and end-all right now, we just want to win the Commonwealth Games, I don't care about anything else, then, okay, you carry on picking the side you've got, you carry on playing Amy Jones in all the games, you carry on playing, you know, Tammy Beaumont in all the games, and, you know, you focus on that. And that's fair enough, if that's your decision. But what I've said is that what you're doing then is you're explicitly saying we are not focused on the next World Cup. We are not doing everything we can to win the next World Cup. Because if you're doing everything you can to win the next World Cup, then you have to a certain extent sacrifice what's coming up this summer, in particular the Commonwealth Games. So you have to say that for some of the matches this summer, and not necessarily the Commonwealth Games itself, but around the Commonwealth Games, for some of the matches this summer, you know, we have to think about who's going to succeed Amy Jones. You know, and you know, one option, and I'm not saying this is necessarily the right option, one option is to say, for example, South Africa, we've got a T20 series, there's three matches there. Bess Heath, you're going to play all three matches in that T20 series. Is Bess Heath a better wicketkeeper right now than Amy Jones? No. Is Bess Heath a better batter right now than Amy Jones? No. Is Bess Heath almost certainly going to be better at both by the time Amy Jones is retired in 4 years' time? Well, yeah, he probably, because Amy Jones would have retired. She won't exist. And we need someone to take over.
She will exist. Nobody's going to exterminate her.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite mean
that.
That
was a bit dark.
You know what I mean. So we need to think about that stuff. Another thing that Mark Robinson said that was really fascinating on the Naughty Child podcast.
Yeah.
He said, for example, don't play Tammy in some of these series.
Yeah.
And that was really interesting. Why did he say that? Or to kind of paraphrase him, what he said was, well, you know everything there is to know about Tammy. You don't need to find out what Tammy can do against South Africa. You don't. If you rested Tammy for everything, say, but the test, for all the ODIs and the T20 series against South Africa, so you're playing the test, but we're going to rest you for these games. You'll obviously be back for the Commonwealths, and maybe for the series against India. You know, you can even tell her that in advance. But go, we're going to rest you now, and we're going to, try somebody else in that spot, and that gives the opportunity for somebody else to come in, or it gives the opportunity for England to have the flexibility to bring in Alice Capsey for those games, and actually play Alice Capsey at, three or four in the batting order, and kind of shuffle things around a bit to accommodate her. Because, what ultimately England need to be doing is building a team that is going to be able to take on the world going forwards. And, you can't predict the future, but, that's... our best shot right now at predicting the future is to say that we should be building a team around Alice Capsey, and that's what I think that we should be doing right now.
It was amazing how astute Robbo was on that podcast, given that he hasn't coached the England women's team for 2019, and he's really been out of the women's cricket setup since then. But he still knows everything that's going on, and he still talks about the game with such awareness. So one thing that he said, for example, he was like, England should never have gone into this World Cup and without having tried and tested Emma Lamb and Eve Jones in the opening position. And he was basically like, if it had been me, then I would have, last summer against India and New Zealand, I would have been playing both of them as openers. And I would have been going, okay, show us that you can do this at international level. Because we don't know yet, because they've not had a chance to do it. I mean, Emma Lamb has had, two chances. Did she bat? Has she only opened once? And but it's just...
It's not the tag end of the Ashes series where you're facing, Elise Perry in her pond.
I mean, it's just not fair on somebody to do that at that point. So, and what Robbo was saying was, actually, in most series, he was quite happy when he was coached to lose 2-1. Really interesting observation because to win 2-1, but he didn't mind the possibility of losing a few matches. And he was basically like, outside of the Ashes and outside of World Cups, England were not necessarily challenged to the extent that you need to be totally obsessed with playing your number one best 11. So you need to blood new players. And I just thought that was really interesting. And it's so right, because England did come into this World Cup with this sort of opening dilemma that they hadn't solved. And they just had to sort of jiggery-pokery around and obviously ended up promoting Danny Wyatt. But that's not the way to approach.
They shouldn't have been winging it in the World Cup.
And it's just so short-sighted, because we were saying last summer, you've got to be thinking about the World Cup. And they just weren't. They were obsessed with, we have to play Catherine Brunt in every game. We have to have the same openers in every game. We have to do this. It's like, no, you don't. And I just thought that was really interesting. So I totally agree with you that England's problem is a kind of chronic lack of vision and a kind of chronic short-sightedness about the way in which they approach. It's all about winning the next game, and it's just got to stop. Okay. Shall we move on from the World Cup, Sid, as England are obviously hoping to do after their 4 weeks off? Because we've also had some news coming through this week about various other things, but in particular the Women's 100. There's been some new signings announced, hasn't there, Sid? So what's the landscape looking like now?
Well, I think what we've seen is that the the fact that the Australian, the top Australians and the top New Zealanders are coming back and have made themselves available this year means that pretty much everybody is in a position to strengthen their team, and they have done. The two teams that haven't strengthened quite so much are the two teams that were most successful last year. So Southern Brave, who have kept a very, very similar core team, and Oval Invincibles, the same. You know, in some ways, you go, they didn't have very much to improve. I mean, Oval Invincibles could have potentially looked to improve their batting, but difficult to do, given that, you know, that they'd already kind of had a lot of their top spots filled in terms of overseas and in terms of salary, in order to, you know, maintain that bowling attack that's done them so much good. And, you know, Southern Brave are in a similar situation. They already had a very good core, so, you know, kind of why break that up? I can see the logic in that. But almost everybody else has improved. I think we're going to see a very competitive tournament. We'll see to talk a lot more about that, you know, going forwards, and especially just before the tournament. But I think, you know, reasons for kind of all of those other teams to celebrate and to look forward to it and to think that they can be competitive. And I think it's going to be a very close competitive tournament, and it should be a good one.
Fantastic. In other news this week as well, Cricket Australia have announced their contracted players list for the year going forwards.
What did you make of that, Raf?
Well, there weren't particularly any surprises. They've brought Alana King in for her, I think it's her first ever central contract, which is really exciting for her. Not particularly a surprise because she was so important for them in their World Cup campaign.
Yeah, I mean, she's played virtually all their games in the last few months. So, and that's the way Australia tend to do things, isn't it, a little bit? They tend to kind of, once somebody's played several games, then they'll give them a central contract as kind of reward from that. It's awesome. You know, something that of the approach that they do, where actually you have to go out there and play games and prove yourself on that stage before you get that central contract.
Yeah. The person to miss out, actually, maybe a little bit of a surprise, was Sophie Molyneux, who's missed the World Cup through injury.
Yeah,
so
a bit
not
ruthless.
Through any fault of her own. Well, it is ruthless. In some ways, you think actually England could do with being a little bit more ruthless sometimes, rather than perpetually keeping people on central contracts when they literally haven't played a match for England for like years on end. I think that was interesting. They did kind of stress in the press release, well, you know, it's just because it's a very competitive field and we have to kind of give contracts to people who are currently performing on the international stage.
And of course Australia do bring people into the team that aren't contracted. That's important to remember, as they did with Alana King. The other thing to remember is that over the last few years, I don't know exactly what the situation is this year, you know, things might have, the balance might have changed slightly, but generally over the last few years the situation in terms of the money that you get is there's a much bigger balance in Australia between match fees, or a much better balance between match fees and the central contract fees. In other words, if you play all the games, you'll get quite a lot of money. Whereas in England, it's the central contract that's the key to it, and the match fees are much smaller. If you play all the games, you won't get anything like as much money as the people that are on the central contracts.
That's fair.
Whereas
enough.
I understand in Australia, the balance is much better there.
And obviously, Molyneux's got a lot to fall back on in terms of the brilliant state setup that they've got in Australia. I've no doubt that we will see her in the green and gold again before too long. That was interesting. The other thing that was interesting about the press release was actually that they put the players' clubs on the press release, which a few people have commented on, and it's the first time they've done it in a while, actually. And I just thought that was quite interesting, and to some extent is something that we've really moved away from in England, is that connection of the international players with the grassroots setup.
It's very interesting because Matthew Moss, in his post World Cup press conference, also mentioned the importance of a strong club setup, didn't he?
Yeah.
So do you think something's going on here? I think it's some sort of holistic approach.
Well, it's possible that in terms of like the marketing, they've decided that this is something that they need to emphasise. I know that that's your theory, isn't it, Sue?
Yeah, it just feels like the marketing people have gone, you know, we need to emphasise the importance of clubs and of, you know, of kind of rooting the game in the clubs because it brings it closer to the people. And it also, you know, it shows that Australia have this holistic approach where they're already not just thinking. I mean, we've just skinned England alive for not even thinking about 3 years' time. Australia are thinking about 20 years' time. They're going, how can we get 5-year-old girls down to cricket clubs and make them, you know, want to actually get involved in this system right from the off?
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, we're barely thinking about how we can get 20-year-old girls into regional teams. So,
yeah, it is a different approach.
Different
gravy. I think the last time that any England cricket press release mentioned any England women's club was in about 2013. So there's really since then been this huge disconnect. Yeah, so that was interesting. Another bit of news this week that we should mention briefly, Mignon de Pria has announced her retirement from ODIs and tests, interestingly, despite the fact that I think that she last played one in 2014. But obviously South Africa have got one coming up, so she's basically said, I'm not going to be playing in that, I'm not going to be playing in the ODIs, but I am, I think, available for selection in the T20s and I guess in the Commonwealth Games, and presumably what she's really targeting is the T20 World Cup at home next year in South Africa.
Yeah, I'm sure she will be keen to still play in that. I mean, yeah. You know, that's all up to the South African selectors ultimately whether they select her. And obviously, she definitely, it seems like, to carry on playing, you know, in franchise tournaments and things over the next few years. Mm-hmm. And why not if she's got the fitness and the talent to do that? But she's also saying, you know, what she wants to do is, you know, spend more time with her husband and to start a family of her own, ultimately.
Exciting.
And, you know, good luck to her with that. She's had a fantastic career. She was somebody that was, you know, she got appointed to the South African captaincy when she was still reasonably young, in her early 20s. And she was the first captain of the kind of new professional era, if you like. She worked incredibly hard, you know, doing marketing stuff and, you know, trying to build the game. And they were originally employed on sort of marketing kind of contracts. So whereas England had these chance to shine contracts where the girls were asked to go and do coaching and work in schools and that kind of thing, the original South African contracts were, you know, you have to do marketing appearances and events and promotional things. And she, you know, she worked incredibly hard to do that. And she was quite good at it. But obviously, you know, it meant that, you know, she had to kind of do things that were kind of beyond cricket, if you like, and pay a great deal of attention to how she presented herself and how she presented the team, and to kind of lead that presentational thing. And an incredible job she did that in the early years, and built the situation where after she stepped down from the captaincy, you know, it meant that South Africa were then in a position where they could go forward with a much more kind of classically professional cricketing setup. And then she took advantage of that. You know, and I mean, you know, she's incredibly fit. She works really hard on her fitness. You know, she runs really hard. She's worked very hard in her T20 game over the last few years. That wasn't necessarily her natural game. You know, she was much more suited to the longer forms of the game. She played one, I think she only played one test match overall. And she's got a test century, which kind of says it all, really, that she was someone that was kind of better in those longer formats, but she worked really hard to build that T20 game. You know, she was responsible for, you know, very much for so many close finishes where South Africa got over the line, you know, and she's been a great servant to them. And hopefully we'll still see her playing T20 cricket, particularly in the franchises. Looking forward to seeing her back in England later this year.
Great. Okay. And finally... We really have banged on a bit this week, Sid. If you're still with us, we were going to talk a little bit about the Fairbreak tournament, which is due to take place... when is it going to happen? It's this summer, isn't it?
Yeah, it's something about a month's time, I think.
Okay, oh, so it's quite soon. And that is going to be in Dubai. And it has been in the news quite a bit recently. Lots of high-profile signings of late from various teams. There was obviously that exclusive on the Naughty Child podcast about Danny Wyatt's going to be there. So we know that there's going to be...
Accidental exclusives.
Yeah, we know that there's going to be some England players, so the ECB are releasing some players. On the kind of flip side of that, the BCCI have... it's become public this week that the BCCI have said that they are not going to grant no objection certificates. So that means that we're not going to see any of the Indian women playing in the Fairbreak tournament. So it's an interesting one, isn't it, Sid? Because we actually met Sean Martin almost a decade ago now, when they were first conceiving of having a women's independent or women's international
cricket league
in 2013. And the world's changed quite a lot since then.
Yeah, it has. So the no objection certificates thing, just for anyone that isn't clear on that, so basically each individual cricket board has the ability to veto any of their players playing in any other tournament outside of their own borders. So if, you know, Nat Silver wants to go and play in the WBBL, she has to get a no objection certificate from the ECB to say we don't object to Nat going to Australia and playing in the WBBL. And that's the same with all the boards everywhere. So that's an ICC thing. And it gives the boards essentially the right to go, no, we want to, you know, we're not going to let you do that. We're going to arrest you for this. We don't want you playing in that, blah, blah, blah. So it keeps the boards in control. So India have essentially gone, we're not going to give no objection certificates to the Indians, even though there were some Indian players that had already basically signed, presumably subject to those and OCs.
Yeah.
So and there's been a little bit of controversy about that and a little bit of disappointment. It's kind of an interesting one, isn't it? So I think we need to look at what Fair Break is. What Fair Break is it's a semi-independent franchise cricket tournament that sits outside of the direct control of the boards.
Yeah.
So we've seen they can veto players playing, but essentially it's not a board tournament. It's sanctioned by the ICC, so you know it's not a rebel tournament, but it's outside the control of the boards. And that's not a value judgment, that's simply a statement of fact. It is true that that is the case.
Yeah.
But what that really means is that if Fair Break is successful, as clearly it hopes to be, and you know, I'm sure that Sean Martin, who is a you know an affable but very driven businessman, you know, and he won't have lost any of his ambition to build a truly global cricket tournament for, around which women's cricket can base itself. If Fair Break is successful, it is a threat to the boards. Absolutely, it is. Now that might be you know it might be right or wrong. You might support it or you might not do, but it is a threat. So for me, the surprise is not that the BCCI have joined Cricket Australia, and you know, there's no Australian players going. We've seen no Australian names
yeah,
mentioned.
That's a good point.
BCCI have joined them. There's actually one small exception to that. I might come back to in a second. BCCI have joined Cricket Australia in saying no. And the real surprise for me is that the ECB have said yes, because it is a threat to the future of the 100. Okay. It is a threat to the future of WBBL and the women's IPL, etc.
The one
exception is Kim Garth appears to be signed up. Now, I don't know who is responsible for issuing Kim Garth's no objection certificate. I don't know if it's still Ireland or if it would be Australia that was responsible for issuing that.
But she's trying to qualify for Australia, yeah, so you'd think it would be Cricket Australia.
I thought
Australia.
She was. Technically, she was qualified for Australia,
yeah.
But I don't know whether Australia gets to issue the NOC okay. until she actually plays for Australia.
Well, that's very interesting. I think it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because people are making a song and dance about the BCCI, but nobody's said anything about Cricket Australia. Presumably, there's an aspect there. It's partly to do with how well the players are remunerated by the board, because obviously this going off and playing in the Fair Break tournament is going to be more attractive if you're less well paid. Because I assume that somebody like Danny Wyatt is not going to go to Dubai for a couple of weeks to play in this.
She's not getting out of bed for a lollipop and
exactly a pat on the back. Yeah. So the pay is going to they've got the money from somewhere to pay the players a decent amount of money, and it's obviously very exciting.
But it's being sponsored by Hong Kong businesses. Also, okay. It was originally intended to be held in Hong Kong, so okay. They've kept the sponsorship carrying
so
over.
So it's obviously very exciting for some of those players, some of the players from kind of associate or affiliate nations who don't get those opportunities to kind of play alongside those big names. I just feel like it's a little bit interesting how that they're selecting the teams, which seems to be just being done on a kind of quite a random basis. So that's interesting. And the other thing that is interesting is, as you say, it's partly it comes down to a bit of a battle between board power and player power. And what I meant by the fact that the world has kind of moved on since 2013, when this tournament was originally conceived by Sean Martin and Lisa Slater at that point, is that at that point, the boards basically managed to squash it. They basically managed to go, okay, well, I remember the Giles Clarke at the UCB was particularly against the idea of any English players going and playing in this tournament, and the boards managed
to quote Giles Clarke.
So the boards managed to basically squash it at that time. Now it seems to have kind of revived, and the boards almost are no longer able to just turn around and say, we don't want our players playing in it. I mean, obviously that's what the BCCI and maybe Cricket Australia have done, we don't know. But there's almost like a shift in the balance of power, and that's really interesting to me.
Yeah.
I do take your point about it being a threat to the boards, and what we're going to increasingly see, and we're almost at that point now, is that the women's calendar, for years we've called for more cricket, the women's calendar is at the point now where it's quite congested, and it's about to become more so, because not only are you going to have the WBBL and the 100, you're also going to have, by this time next year, we've been promised a full IPL, women's IPL,
Caribbean
a full Women's Caribbean Premier League, a full Pakistan women's league, whatever their one's
called. Claire Bress is saying they want to run this thing twice a year, and they'll want, you know, some star names in that twice a year.
There you go. So how on earth is the women's calendar going to support all of these tournaments? I can't see it.
Ultimately, it's not. And somebody's going to be a winner, and somebody's going to be a loser. And if I was the boards, I would be squashing Fairbreak again.
Oh, okay. But
that doesn't mean that's the right thing to do. Yeah, I'm not saying that I would be happy if the boards squash Fairbreak.
Yeah, it's just an interesting dilemma, isn't it? And it's going to be really interesting to see how it plays out.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we really have gone on for I think this is probably our longest episode.
Longest cricket hell weekly ever.
So sorry about that. We'll hopefully try and keep it a bit snappier next week. If you're still with us at this point, thanks so much for bearing with our ramblings as usual. And we'll see you next week. Bye for now.